everybody. Shavuot Tov. It is Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation for the Land of Israel. Today is September 11th, 2016, the eighth day of Elul, 5776. I'm here in Jerusalem with Ben Bresky, and of course wanting to thank Tabitha and Jeremy and Ari and everybody who makes this broadcast possible. But I have across the screen from me on Skype, Eric Ross, who it turns out, as a way of doing penance, I suppose, we'll talk about what being Catholic means, has my voice in his head. He just told me it was so bad. Oh my goodness, what did you do in a former life for this one? Anyway, Eric is probably known to many of you. He's been on Yishai's show over the years and has definitely checked in when it comes to Israel and the voice of Israel and the land of Israel and all kinds of different things that we're doing over here. But this is my first time getting to talk to him and actually getting to see him. So Eric, thank you so much for, I understand, missing Mass this morning in order to be on Rejuvenation.
Well, I never missed Mass on a Sunday.
Did I just get you into trouble?
Okay. No. We have plenty of Masses to choose from, so I just had to move it from the 7 a.m. Mass to a later one, so I'll still be going today.
Okay. We have that also in Judaism, the early minyan, their early prayers, and then the later ones, and then Chabad, who show up at around 10 o'clock in the morning. So, yeah, we're into that. But my Yeki, my German genes have me usually doing things early, and we'll talk about my gene pool, which... weird coincidence you kind of didn't fall into, but are familiar with now. But first of all, for my listeners who are not familiar with you, Wisconsin boy, now in Poland, and very involved with the Catholic Church. Just give us a little bit of background on your journey.
Well, I mean, I was born in a place called Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Very glamorous sounding. It's north of Milwaukee. There's a movie called Some Like It Hot, which is from the early 60s. I think it's a Billy Wilder movie. And Marilyn Monroe is in that film. And in the film, she's a graduate of the Sheboygan Academy of Music. That is about as much fame as Sheboygan has ever achieved. Mm-hmm. And then I was raised in Milwaukee, which is just, you know, between Chicago and Sheboygan.
Yes.
And that is where the famous Israeli is from. I'm giving you a quiz, Eve. What famous woman Israeli?
Golda Meir.
Correct. Yes. And yes. So they're very proud of her there. They have a huge library named after her and a school. And so that's the connection to Israel from my background. But of course, I'm not at all Jewish, or I have nothing to do with really Poland either, ethnically speaking. I'm like a Scottish American, basically.
Okay.
So I couldn't get more mainstream American than that. You know, the family that I come from, the Ross family, has been in the States since the 1750s, something like that. So it's many, many generations of
dairy farmers, or that's a total stereotype of people from Wisconsin.
Well, that would be on my mom's side. She's the Wisconsin person. My dad is not. So those are Wisconsin people. Those are sort of mid 19th century German immigrants, right? They didn't do any farming, from what I know. I think my great-grandfather was a bartender, which is a very Wisconsin-y thing when you think about the beer. You know, that's a very Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was a good student, and I went to study at Georgetown University, which is in Washington, to do international relations when I was 18. And I really haven't moved back permanently to Milwaukee since then. But I have a really big family. I mean, we are Catholics. My parents are very vigorously Catholic, let's put it that way. They're very involved, and they had eight children, of which I am the first. So now five of my siblings are married. I have 20 going on 23 because there are three pregnancies, nieces and nephews now. Mm-hmm. So when I come back, there's a huge tribe of family to greet me. Everyone's still based in that part of the country. So that's
right. Since my listeners can't see your face, which is the downside of radio, so I'm going to tell them that you are very smiley and enthusiastic when you're talking about this large family. However, as someone who's gone into the priesthood, that's not a direction that you're going to be taking, right?
And that is true.
Raising your own family.
Yeah, but you failed to mention that I am indeed a Catholic priest.
Oh.
That is a new fact of my life, because I have been a Dominican friar, which is a kind of monk. I know that the word friar in Hebrew and Yiddish is not necessarily a very nice word, but it means like a kind of a monk, you know, you live in community, you don't have any personal property, you know, right. You think you use things, but you don't own them, you don't have a bank account, and you have to be obedient to a superior. Now, I've been doing that in Poland since at least 2006.
How does this happen? Also, by the way, isn't it usual in families, I know European families, right, where the oldest son, and you said you're the oldest, inherits the property or the title, and the second one goes to the church. So what happens? Oh. What happened with you?
I don't think that rule is any longer in effect.
At least doesn't apply in Wisconsin, right?
Never heard of that. I mean, I read about it in history class, but I don't think that have. I mean, you know, it took me a long time. I'm in my late 30s now, so you know, it was a very long road. I was always a pious Catholic, someone who went to church a lot. My parents mm-hmm. go to church a lot, and I embraced that. So, like, when I went away to college, I didn't have that reaction of rejecting everything that was in my past and escaping from the strictures of religion. Instead, I kind of made it my own, you know, mm-hmm. so I was, you know, singing in the choir and organizing a club and making a lecture, you know, like that kind of thing. A student leader or whatever you would want to say, you know, as a young adult. So it took a long time. I speak few languages. I speak French and Italian and now also Polish and, you know, obviously my own language. Mm-hmm. I studied in Paris. I studied in Rome. I worked at Vatican Radio when I was in Rome, which is why I love radio. And I was looking around at the church, you know, what's going on, what communities are there, what are the new types of liturgical music, what are mm-hmm. young people doing? And of course, Vatican Radio is, you're working in and for the Pope, you know, so you could hardly get more churchy than that.
Right.
And one time in, you know, 1999, I went here to Poland for an academic conference, and we were housed as students. We were housed inside of a monastery of the Dominican order, which is the order that I now belong to. Now, of course, at the time, I didn't speak a word of Polish, and it would have been bizarre for me to think about living in that monastery. But, you know, through meeting the Dominicans, through, you know, the example of real living men that I could actually meet and talk to, I, you know, step by step over a few years, got closer and closer to the Dominicans, and eventually I joined, and I had a long process of formation that went on for at least 10 years. You know? Mm-hmm. So here I am. Now I am a full-fledged Dominican. I wear a white habit, which is like a robe with a hood and a belt and a rosary, which is like prayer beads that we wear. And I'm just starting out my first assignment as a priest. So I work in like a publishing house that we run, our own publishing house. It's actually, I'm sitting in the office of the publishing house now, so I don't disturb my neighbors in my room down there. And I say a lot of masses, which is leading the community in prayer. I hear confessions for at least an hour every day. This is a very Catholic country here in Poland. In a way, going to Poland for a Catholic guy is like making Aliyah in a
right,
way.
For a Jewish person.
You're going to this like a very pious center with a long Catholic history. I think today in Europe, really there's no contest. Poland is the only really fervently Catholic country.
More than Italy.
Oh, much so. I mean, culturally speaking, it's pretty much the same, where it's practically everyone has been Catholic for practically ever, you know. Mm-hmm. But in this country, people actually go to church a lot.
As opposed to Italy, yes.
Right.
And Italy, where they point out all the churches and there is no other religion besides Roman Catholicism, but they don't necessarily go. So let me ask you something, though, because I'm going to imagine that I don't have too many Catholic listeners. I would say that probably most of the people who listen to the Land of Israel Network or who are interested in Israel, obviously there are Jews who do so, but I'd say I think that most of the Christians who do are probably more from the Protestant side of things, Baptist and that, the Bible Belt, if you will. Why is that? Why is it that there is a tendency to at least think, and if I'm wrong, that's why I wanted to talk to you, that Catholics are less enamored of their Jewish brothers, less involved or excited about even the reestablishment of the Jewish presence and sovereignty in the Land of Israel? Like, what has happened here over the years? Do you feel that way? Because I think you are somewhat of an anomaly, somebody who's very deeply into the Catholic world, but also very connected to Israel, has visited here many times, is very involved with Jewish Catholic relations. So what is there a moment in your life where something clicked? Is that where you rebelled a little bit? Because in some terms, you've What happened?
Well, I mean, rebelled, if you say rebelled, I always think about rebelling against your parents or your grandparents, your immediate family. That's definitely not the case. My parents are really pro-Israel people and very, I mean, let's say philo-Semitic. They had Jewish friends growing up. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Wisconsin specifically, that was sort of a very Germanic, Central European group of American settlers, in the middle of the 19th century. And Jews came with the Germans and the Czechs and the Poles that came to that. So, and then also after, unfortunately, the Holocaust, some of the refugees landed in Wisconsin because they had family connections. So my mother grew up, she is the peer of the generation of the children of the survivors. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So her friends, some of her friends were the children of survivors.
Right.
And she remembers going to synagogues and stuff, for family occasions when she was growing up. So that's all kind of in there. There's not a large Jewish community in Wisconsin, but it's definitely there.
So you grew up kind of exposed to Jews in a social, maybe cultural sense, not so much from the theological aspect?
No, not from the theological aspect, but also from the cultural sense. I mean, for one thing, one of my best high school teachers that I am almost embarrassed to say I'm still very much in touch with, decades later, was a pious Jewish woman. And she taught history, it's a subject that both of us, you and I, love, And she was so brilliant, a brilliant teacher, but also just a brilliant person. So that definitely, if I hadn't been there, hugely positive. And she was very Jewish. So she was out of school, on Rosh Hashanah, and none of us knew what that was. But we certainly learned from her, what it was.
Right.
It was delightful, And then also, I'm American, and that helps a lot. Because although I've lived most of my adult life out of America, by this time, it's certainly more than half of my adult life has been lived in Poland, France, Switzerland, and Italy. I was in Switzerland for 3 years over the last, 5 years. So it's, that's my life.
Right.
But being American, you pick up a lot of Judaism or a lot of Jewish culture, if you're if you're aware and if you're thinking, you would really have to be deaf and blind not to, watch a Mel Brooks movie, or see Woody Allen or listen to Seinfeld or whatever. And my Jewish friends in Israel sometimes, seems a little surprised and almost apprehensive that I will understand a Yiddish expression, although I don't usually feel comfortable using them myself. I feel like that's a little much. But when I write,
because we are not used to that.
Yeah, but I keep saying to them, you can't have it both ways. You guys are incredibly culturally fertile and productive, and you've done amazing things for American culture. Of course I'm aware of, bagels and lox. It comes up,
Right, right. Okay, but as a Catholic priest, you understand Judaism as it's not bagels and lox. So have there been times where, as you get deeper and deeper into Catholic theology, now you're a teacher of it. You're not just someone who's a part of the world, you're actually someone who's seen as an example, who, as you said, is hearing confession, is seen as really someone who embodies Catholicism to a great many people. Have there been situations, though, where you've seen that there's some kind of conflict with Judaism, or, to really jump into it since you are in Poland, where actually some Catholic feeling has even caused grave harm to Jews? I don't know how else to put that.
Yeah, well, you have to distinguish the theological and then the ethnic and political, and that's really hard in this country, My first job out of college was actually in Manhattan at a monthly magazine called First Things, which you can find today at firstthings.com. It's been around for 30 years. And since its beginning, it has been a Jewish, Protestant, and Catholic monthly publication about, religion and public affairs. And in the office, we had Jews and Christians together. And among the writers and the editors, it was Jews and Christians together. And in America, that was totally fine. And especially in New York City, that was totally normal. And it was very fruitful for me. I mean, I learned a ton from, professors at Yeshiva University, like Shalom Carmi, who wrote for our publication and who came to our conferences and stuff like that. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs was invited recently to speak to them. Like that in America is fine. And no one would dare to suppose that that was out of order or wrong. In Poland, it's hard to be anti-Semitic, really, practically speaking, in Poland now, because there are no Jews.
Right.
Alas.
Well, they did a good job of getting rid of all the Jews 7 years ago.
You're kind of right, but of course it's a German, you know, the Holocaust is a German initiative, yeah. You know, and I'm not a Polish patriot, I'm not Polish at all, ethnically speaking, but we, even though the record of the Poles themselves is very spotty with mm-hmm. the Jews, to put it mildly, mm-hmm. they still did not have an industrial plan of extermination and, you know, genocide. That was a German invention, and right. the Poles feel badly today, you know, that foreign people that were their enemies, the Germans, mm-hmm. conquered them against their will. The Poles were fighting tooth and nail with the Germans. The French didn't fight that hard with the Germans. The Czechs let them come into Prague, you know, just lay down their arms. The Austrians, the same. But the Poles, you know, mobilized the whole army. And the Jewish community, especially here in Poznan, because I looked it up, was praying for the success of the Polish war effort. Mm-hmm. But it lasted for about 7 days in September. Actually, we're in September.
Right.
Of 1939. So it was a pitiful war effort. They failed miserably.
And then after that, it really becomes the focal point for the extermination of the Jews.
Well, I mean, that's, you have, yeah, you have a foreign people coming into, from the Polish point of view, foreigners come to your country, they commit one of the worst crimes of all of history, if not the worst. And then they go home. You know, and after the war, West Germany becomes a very wealthy country, you know, and is now leading Europe under Merkel. They're really in charge. Mm-hmm. Whereas Poland was behind the Iron Curtain until 1989, right. really recently. And they were poor, poor, poor all that time. And all of the things that go with poverty, you know, like bad medical care, bad universities, alcoholism, whatever you want to think about. They were suffering from that. And all of the places on their map that they associate with other things in Polish history have now been perverted to be Holocaust camps. This is the Polish way of thinking.
Yeah, so, I understand the Polish way of thinking. Yeah. But as a Jew, it's hard for me to feel bad for the Poles. No, it really is. It's hard after the Holocaust for me to feel bad for the Poles, understanding that, okay, they weren't the organizational branch, maybe, of the Holocaust. They didn't put the machine into play. That was German intelligence, if you will. But they, with more than a little bit of enthusiasm, rolled right into the game. And that it seems that, to get back to the religious aspect of what you said, that the Poles are very Catholic, that they found some justification, if not a lot of justification, for what they were doing through the religion. Like the Jews were being punished, and they were the people punishing the Jews. But we had brought it upon ourselves for abandoning God and all those things that you know very well. How do you fit that in to where you are and your clear understanding, and I would say even tremendous love to a great degree of the Jewish people? How are you able to work all that in, especially now sitting in Poland itself?
I mean, it is the word love is very well chosen. That is exactly how I relate to the Jews. And I think that Jewish people, some of them, sense that from me, which is why there is certain trust in my friendships, you know, in my relationships mm-hmm. with Jewish people, especially in Israel. But it's a personal thing. Some Jewish friends perceive in me a genuine love. And they don't necessarily look at the fact that I'm a Dominican friar or that I'm a priest, but they know that I'm their friend. And that's mm-hmm. that's about as much as I can possibly hope for. Because the history is really hard. I mean, it would be totally dishonest to, like, you know, get into a debate with you and deny and say, oh, no, Eve, you know, the Catholic Church has been really nice to the Jews. That's impossible. That's not the history. There have, of course, been many instances of heroic individuals and even heroic right. communities that were Catholic in the Holocaust, but also going back to, you know, the 15th century and the 13th century, and popes or bishops who, even certain bishops in Germany who would, like, rule over a small town mm-hmm. or rule over a region, and the Jews were the victims of a pogrom, and this goes back to before the 13th century, and the bishop who would be in a castle, because he was the secular ruler, would open up the castle, bring in all the Jews, close right. the gate, and keep the peasants
away. But that those were very much the exceptions to the
indeed.
Rule. And then you have something like the Inquisition, which is,
oh my,
you know,
yeah.
Over 100 years of either you convert to Catholicism or you're killed, or even if you do convert, you might be killed anyway, because we don't, so, you know, we still suspect you of.
Exactly.
I mean, so you can see why, as Jews, and you know enough Jews probably to understand this, there is this sense that Catholicism, there's something inherent in Catholicism that is not, doesn't make us feel good. So
well,
you,
this, I understand.
Yeah.
I understand it only by listening and hoping with empathy, trying to understand. I mean, you are talking to a Catholic priest, so I would say that I want to always distinguish, and in Poland especially, because there's this thousand-year history, you know, here, and there's this ethnic identity. Poles are Polish. They look Polish. They're all white-skinned. They eat Polish food. This is not like in America, where it's a multicultural society from the start.
Right.
So there's a certain tribalism and also a certain, you know, homogeneity, and people are a little bit more limited or blinkered in their worldview. So I when I'm teaching here, because I teach in Polish. Polish is my primary language now. And I try to always draw a very clear distinction between Catholic theology, which is considered holy, you know, like a good thing, and sort of ethnic and intertribal, intergroup experiences and relationships. Polish Catholic relationships or Polish Christian relationships shouldn't be the same as Jewish Catholic relationships or Jewish Christian shouldn't be the same as Polish Jewish relationships. In other words, the theological conversation should not be contaminated by the ethnic history that's here. At least that's what I hope.
So what now that you have a responsibility as a teacher, as a priest? I mean, you now have a responsibility. People are listening to you, just like you listened to your Jewish teacher, your history teacher, and you still speak to her. People are now listening to you. So do you try and work in some kind of understanding, in some way, try and fix a little bit in the 21st century some of what has so destroyed that kind of trust that you speak about? You've earned that trust on an individual level with Jews, and if you're friends with Yishai Fleischer, he's definitely a very devout Jew through and through. Trust is not an easy thing. So how do you take that, though, to your own people now? And what do you do?
If you or your listeners kind of want to see a real example of the kind of stuff that I do, go to the Times of Israel. Their website is thetimesofisrael.com. I have a regular blog there. I write several times a month for them. And you'll see, I mean, I'm writing for a Jewish audience there, but I have a style of weaving in a Christian element with Jewish references so that it's not completely deracinated, because that's what's happening. When Christians pretend that our religion comes from, you know, planet X, that it had no earthly genesis, you know, they're denying their own roots. And theologically, that's a big problem, because they're denying the truth of their own faith, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I think this is also backed up by a lot of official church teaching. Yes. You know, Jesus was a Jew from the land of Israel. He was born in Bethlehem.
From Judea.
From Judea, exactly. He was born in Bethlehem, which is in Judea, and he was born to a Jewish couple who practiced, we imagine, all of the Jewish laws. We know that he was dedicated in the temple, so probably he had a bris, you know, and he was a Jewish man who lived a Jewish life in a Jewish country, and people need to know that. So when I'm preaching in Poland, I never stint from referring to, let's say, Mary, the mother of Jesus, and I'll say, a Jewish girl called Mary received a revelation from an angel that Jesus would be conceived in, like that kind of thing. And in Poland, that sounds a little strange, because the word Jew in Polish is Żyd, which, if people know Russian, sounds derogatory. In Russian, it's always negative to say Żyd. In Poland, there is no other word. It's not a bad thing to say that word, but it does still have a little bit, sort of like in English too. If you say the word Jew with the wrong intonation, it sounds like an
insult. You're right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so people in church sit up when I use that adjective to describe Jesus, who is,
to put it in context is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, I want to link, and also there's an old school of thinking, which is incorrect from an official Catholic point of view, which would say, you know, the people of Israel are the people of the Tanakh, you know, they're the people of the Torah.
The Old Testament.
The Old Testament. And thank you for translating my Hebrew. It's really great. But, you know, and they'll say, oh, that was very holy. Yeah, Moses, that's great. And Joshua, that's wonderful. And the prophets. But after Jesus, then there is no more Israel. There are only Jews. Mm-hmm. That's a quote from a very old professor that I had. And of course, my hand went up immediately in class. I was like, that is, first of all, it's stupid and incorrect. But also, it is actually in contradiction to written instructions on theology coming from the Vatican itself. The Vatican, since 1965, in very explicit terms, has taught about the continuity, moral continuity, between today's Jewish people and the people of the Bible, which means that the covenant with the Jews, the covenant of Abraham was never broken, because, you know, God is eternal. He is above and beyond all time and space, and he doesn't change his mind. He doesn't say,
he keeps his promises.
Exactly. Yes. He doesn't say, I promise you forever until next Tuesday afternoon. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. So now the Catholic Church, these days, like, you know, this decade, this week, you know, we are in a situation where theologically, I think the Church has gone way ahead of where it is in terms of its politics or its organization. If you look in Israel, there is a basic apparatus of the Catholic Church in Israel.
There's
they're present, but their contacts with the Jews have been very mixed. The current Bishop of Jerusalem, who is actually Italian, speaks fluent Hebrew, thank God. Mm-hmm. The previous one did not. The previous one spoke primarily Arabic, and that changed his entire worldview.
Yes, so it did.
I really think we need to work on, you know, good relations that are respectful between the Catholic Church and the Jewish world. And one thing that helps, from my point of view, enormously with the Jewish world is the fact that the Jews are in the land of Israel, because they, the Jews feel, this is my personal experience, and you can tell me what you think, but because the Jews are, from their point of view, they are home. They have a sense of self-confidence and a sense of peace at being rooted in the land. And this makes some Jewish people more generous and certainly less afraid. If I come to your house and I'm the guest, mm-hmm. you don't have to, you know, I follow your rules, and you don't have to necessarily worry that I'm going to do something untoward. And I found that many conversations, if I start by asking permission to cross the doorstep, if I start with humility, mm-hmm. and I'm visiting Jews in their homeland, then Jews have a sense of self-confidence to engage in conversations that they might have avoided in the past. And from the Catholic point of view, our theology has gone forward, thank God, you know, on the Jewish subject, so that I, as a priest, am not considered a heretic for talking to Jews at all.
And you know, do you tell your parishioners, or whatever the word would be, you're doing? Because you as an individual are way ahead of the game. But again, getting back, is that something that the Church is allowing you to do, or do you have to ask permission to, within your own congregation, try and bring people to where you are? Do you see that as something that you want to do, or is this kind of an individual road for you?
And not No, it can't be. I mean, I have committed myself through a vow, a lifelong vow until death, is what I literally said in front of the whole church, you know, years ago when I vowed to join this monastery. I'm going to live in this community under a structure of superiors, under a structure mm-hmm. of obedience. So what I do has to be done with the knowledge of my community, and I want to bring my community along. Now, in Poland, this is one of the largest groups of Dominicans in the whole world. There are about 450 Dominicans in 20 different communities, and they represent four generations, because the youngest one is only 20 years old, and the oldest one is like 95 or 96 years old. So they have all different points of view. They come mm-hmm. from different social classes, and they're all Polish except for me. Okay, so even though I speak really good Polish, I'm still not Polish, and I have to be careful how I talk about these things, because they might feel attacked by a foreign person, me, you know, criticizing them. But what I do
is... You're coming with these American, open-minded, philo-Semitic ideas, and here you come into Poland, and
I mean, honestly, I would never say that I'm philo-Semitic because of the history of that word. Mm-hmm. I'm just a friend of the Jews, or more than that, I just have Jewish friends, because when I say the Jews, it sounds like a theory or an idea, this group of people. Right. But who knows who the Jews are? I know individual Jewish men and women that I trust implicitly, and that mm-hmm. I would give my life for, and that's what I know. But I also make sure that my community always knows what's happening. So if you look at the stuff that I'm writing in the Times of Israel, for example, every single one of those columns has been read by, I guess you could call it a censor. You know, a person who has authority over me, who speaks English, has reviewed all of those columns, and it's with their permission that those things go up in Israel on the website, okay? Right. So this is a good thing, because
it's an amazing thing. But do you think that, this is like a really blunt question, do you think the Holocaust could happen again? Do you think that we are, it's 9/11. It's 15 years since, not just New York City, the entire world was stunned into seeing the immensity of the hatred of, it's religion, it's also political, it's also cultural. There's a lot of things that went into 9/11, and we've all, you know, we know that to a great degree, the threat of, you know, of the West, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we're still in the middle of religious wars right now. You know, and as Jews and as Christians of all stripes, there's another one out there who's now coming at us. So, you know, where do you see us going here as a deeply religious person? And you said you've read, you know, Jonathan Sacks. I just finished his book, you know, Not in God's Name. There is nothing like God, and think you're in someone's interpretation of what he thinks God wants from him to cause people to do things that are as immoral and as heinous as it ever gets.
Yeah.
Where do you think as a Catholic, you know, because yes, as a Jew and as an Israeli Jew, and as a Jew now with an army to protect me, and, you know, we're in a different place right now. But where do you see as a Catholic who's, you know, you don't have your own army. I'm not talking about the Vatican army, because you don't need one. And Europe itself, many people could say, is about to be subsumed by the same wave that hit the world with 9/11, yet they're not really aware of what exactly is happening, because it's happening in a different sense. It's not an airplane smashing into a building. It's kind of waves of people kind of coming in. Where do you see all this? And where do you see a role that you can play in trying to stem that kind of tide? Like, where's your responsibility here as someone who's deeply believing in God? To keep God's name, I know I just asked like 16 gazillion questions, but you know that's what I do. Like, how do we keep God looking good? Because his name has been really dragged through the mud in the last century and more.
That's it. And you know, the title of Rabbi Sacks's book, Jonathan Sacks's book, is Not in God's Name.
Exactly.
And I think you and I would agree that that book is worth reading if anyone can.
Oh, yeah. You know, so how do we as Jews and as Catholics and as Protestants listening or whoever, keep religion from looking bad, because now we're under threat again. Where do you see yourself doing this?
Well, my mission is not to keep religion from looking bad per se. It's just to have an authentic faith. I mean, we would make a distinction between faith, which is a living relationship with a living being, which is God, mm-hmm. As opposed to a religion, which is, I mean, the word in Latin would imply like a set of rules or a set of strictures that one follows. And it's not necessarily, I mean, that's very necessary.
Yes. The same thing in Judaism. We've got the day to day, and then you've got the belief, and not everybody is, doing both of those things.
I want to live within that belief. I want to live within that relationship, that really living daily relationship with God. And if I can be authentic in that relationship, then I can serve. I mean, basically, I would follow Rabbi Sacks. These instances of religious violence, whether it's in the 20th century or in the 8th century, mm-hmm. are the shame of the church. So the truth is, I mean, this is a priest speaking, myself, the more Catholic you are, the more you should fight against this kind of sin. It is a sin, violence, bigotry, even if it's not, murder, but it's just, anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. is sin. And we actually, very ironically almost, you would say, the Polish Pope, of course, John Paul II, who is now called Saint John Paul II officially in the church, he literally said, this is a quote, anti-Semitism is a sin. That was very important in Poland. People actually came after that to the sacrament of confession, which is where, Catholics will tell their sins out loud, individual sins, tell them out loud to a priest, and if they are sorry, will receive absolution. In other mm-hmm. words, they're washed clean of their sins. They would come and say, I have sinned through the sin of anti-Semitism.
But so does Catholicism still think that that's the only way to God is to be a Catholic?
Well, God, no. I mean, if you look at for the Catholic Church, it's easier sometimes than it is for Protestant churches, and certainly and for Judaism, because there is that hierarchical structure, right. which has its problems, obviously. But if you want to ask, what is the teaching? What do Catholics believe? What is their doctrine? You do have a place to turn to. That's the Vatican. And they produce a compendium of Catholic teaching called the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. The latest edition is from 1993. You can find it on the Vatican website in English for free. So it's there. And the teaching is that God is over and beyond. God is utterly other, to put it that way. He's transcendent. Mm-hmm. So even though we believe that the normal means of a person getting to heaven is through what they would call the normal means, mm-hmm. in other words, the regular way, is probably through the sacraments of the Catholic Church, sacraments being sacred rites, prayers and practices. But it doesn't mean that God is restricted by the framework of the church. God, in our view, God created the church. God wanted there to be a church on this earth, and that's why we're here. The Catholic Church is the oldest and largest human organization, just to look at a human level, mm-hmm. of any on earth. We've been around for, by our count, 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. By some other people's count, it could be, not 2,000, maybe 1,500, maybe 1,400. It's still by far the oldest existing mm-hmm. continuously existing organization, and we have over a billion
adherents, right?
Church. So it's by far the largest Christian church. You know,
right?
It's half of all the world's Christians are Roman Catholics. You know, many Latin Americans, many Africans, Asians, right, etc. So it's a big institution, but God is not constricted by this. Mm-hmm. And if someone is not Catholic for one reason or another, especially for good moral reasons, a person believes that he or she is being more faithful to God because he is not Catholic, God sees that. This is a person who is genuinely hungering for a relationship with God, who wants
and
to
that's
be
okay. And that's okay.
Well, how could that be bad?
So, but to get back to, sometimes I think that the Christians have taken the turn the other cheek thing a little bit too far. And that is not, you know, in letting everybody do their own thing, there is a danger here. And that, again, getting back to 9/11. You know, yeah. is there a wake up that, whoa, you know, if we're not careful, if we don't wake up our governments, because we cannot distinguish between, unfortunately, politics and religion. We don't all live in, you know, some kind of like little village where we can just do our own thing. We live in a real world that people make decisions and people go to wars on, you know, those kinds of decisions. Where do you see, like, you know, the Catholic Church coming out and saying, we've got, you know, Islam is a lovely religion for the most part, but the extremist version could be the death of us all. Is there anybody who's going to do that, given that Catholicism itself has had, a difficult history when it comes to religious extremism? Like, is there a lesson that was learned here and internalized that now can be seen as some kind of moral voice in the world?
Well, please God, they have. We have learned our lesson as a Catholic Church. I mean, you're a tough questioner, Eve, because
this was going to be a walk in the park.
No. We started out with religious violence and how it's important for us to renounce it. And now you're talking about times when it's important to be more assertive, including with the use of, I would imagine, armed force. Well, the good news is, from the Catholic point of view, we in European civilization are the inventors of just war theory. In fact, not just are the Catholic Church, you know, the inventors, but Saint Thomas Aquinas, a Catholic Dominican, in other words, my congregation priest, he's one of my models. And, you know, especially he's a theologian from the 13th century. He was born in Italy, but most of his work was done in France and Paris at the brand new Sorbonne, you know, Paris University, which we Dominicans helped to found. The first universities, Oxford, Bologna, Paris, are all part of the Dominicans' initiative in that century. And, you know, Thomas Aquinas, brilliant theologian. He's kind of like a Catholic Maimonides, although he comes a lot later than Maimonides. But he was a systematizer. You know how Maimonides wrote the Guide for the Perplexed, right? And it was supposed to be a simplified, systematized version of theology. Let's call it theology. Mm-hmm. And in the world of Catholic theology, Thomas wrote a Summa, which is the same thing, a summary of theology, a sort of a textbook, very fast textbook. And in here, we will find a very clear, very systematic working out of what a just war is. And the teaching of the church till this day, it's in that catechism that I mentioned, is that sometimes wars are just, not justified, but just. They are right. And sometimes we have a positive obligation to fight. Mm-hmm. You know, if a micro level, if a criminal with a weapon is coming into your home and threatening your wife and children, you better pick up a kitchen knife.
So that's my question. Catholic Europe seeing or even grappling with the question that this may come up? Because I'll tell you, this is where I am in my personal life, but also I think in the life of my people. It's not enough to be good people. It's not enough to set a good example. Sometimes you actually have to say, you have got to wake people up. And you have to take that responsibility, given the history. And if you don't know your history, you got to get out there and learn it. And see the writing on the wall, if you will, to mix a few metaphors here. And say, there's a danger coming, whether it's in the name of God or not. It doesn't matter in whose name it is. And because I have to tell you, Eric, it's rare that I get to have an in-depth conversation with a Catholic. And that's just how the trajectory of my life has run. And that's why I keep coming at this with you, because as someone, again, who's deeply invested in Catholicism, and I see you as someone that people are going to be looking up to, do you have that responsibility to try and, within the Catholic Church? Look, I see it within Judaism. There's things in Judaism that bother a lot of people. And so those of us who love Judaism and from within Judaism are trying to clean it up, not as outsiders and not as threats. Someone is threatening, saying there's things wrong from in-house. We have to fix it.
Yeah.
Do you have that same sense in Catholicism where you're
sitting? You have a duty to your own family first, in a way, you know. And as much as I am always trying to be a bridge builder between mm-hmm. the Catholic world and the Jewish world, and I've got to make sure that my own Catholic house is in order, you know.
Right.
The church is helping me in terms of from the very highest level, from the Vatican level. There's that 1965, the document is called Nostra Aetate in Latin, which means in our time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the church first, in a clear, concise way, formulated who are the Jewish people for us, for Catholics, from our point of view. So things like anti-Semitism are a problem not for the Jews, but for us, first of all.
Exactly.
If we are engaged in anti-Semitism, we're being sinful in our own religious world. So it's a problem for us. And so I teach that. I mean, actually, I have developed like a sort of an evening lecture or course, you know, with little handouts and little games and little things like that. And I've worked this out in French because I was living in the French part of mm-hmm. Switzerland for several years. I worked it out in Polish. I worked it out in English with quotes from Catholic sources and from the Catholic scriptures, too, from the Bible, you know, that that show why Catholics need to clean up their act on this score.
Mm-hmm.
And that lecture has been well received in all of
That's
those.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're talking more about, you know, this idea that Europe is under threat. One thing you have to understand is that from my point of view as a priest, it's important not to talk about Catholic Europe. I mean, that might have been true centuries ago or even one century ago.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly since the Second World War, this has been a profoundly de-Christianized country or de-Christianized
continent.
Continent.
Right, to a great degree.
And that is, to my point of view, that's the problem. Now, a pious Jewish person might say, well, good. I mean, that was a false religion anyway, so I'm glad that they're out of that. But I think you saw, because I know that you just came back from Rome and Florence,
mm-hmm.
you know, you saw that the loss of faith for them also means a loss of conviction. I think, and there was a recent article published here in Poland about this by a priest that I respect, another member of my community, saying Europeans don't know why they are here anymore.
Right.
So far have they lost their moral bearings and their cultural bearings that if you ask them, is it important for there to be an Italian people, for example,
mm-hmm.
50 years from now? They literally would, you know, stutter and hesitate.
I had that conversation with people in Italy. That's exactly what I had.
They don't know what to say. And they're embarrassed by the question. Like, they're afraid of seeming like a triumphalist or colonialist or racist if they say, you know what, I'm Italian and I'm really proud to be Italian. You know, it's hard for them. And the French are even a worse case.
Well, because tribalism, if you want to call it that, or it's belonging to something bigger than you are, is seen as what's brought on world wars and what's seen as devastation. I'm seeing the beginnings of that happening in America also, which I know definitely among my Christian friends in America is something that's worrisome, that sense of cohesion.
Yeah.
But what it also, and this on a practical level, is what should frighten all of us, is that there's then missing the understanding that other people still feel that way, and that other people will go to great lengths in order to make sure that their tribalism takes over our tribalism. Like, you don't feel a certain way, you have to still have the understanding that other people do and have that awareness.
Yeah, I think we have to talk about what is the Catholic Church at its best, because we've talked a lot about what the Catholic world has been at its absolute worst. You know, when people who claim to be Catholic are killing Jews, I think we can say that that is the absolute nadir. That's the lowest of the low. But you can also look at the Catholic Church in its best, and that's something that, you know, I also look at the Jewish world and try to say what's most beautiful, what's best about
right.
this people, this religion, this tradition. So at its best, I mean, the word Catholic comes from a Greek word meaning universal. So the Catholic Church, especially in Europe, this is a continent that recently, from our point of view, has undergone two world wars. They started, they call
right.
them world wars, but they started here.
Right.
So intertribal, inter-ethnic, international conflicts don't just have to do with Catholics and Jews. They have to do with, you know, French and German, for
exactly.
example.
Right.
And the Catholic Church foresaw this already in the very early Middle Ages, at the time of Charlemagne, at the time of the fall of the Roman Empire. And we were the first to build, the Catholic Church, the Pope, the first to build a network of permanent embassies. The word embassy is a Catholic invention. The passport and the diplomatic diplomatic papers or the letter of presentation for a diplomat are all Catholic inventions. Mm-hmm. The idea of permanently stationing an ambassador in a foreign capital is all an invention of the Roman Catholic Church, of the Pope. The idea was, we are a universal community of Catholics or of Christians, and I, let's say I'm the Pope, it is important for me, the Pope, that there be peace among my children. You know, it's important for God that there be peace among his children. So Catholicism, and I see this in Poland. I mean, look at the map of Europe. Poland, where I'm sitting right now, is the last Catholic country on the map going east. After you go east, mm-hmm. You're into Belarus and Ukraine and Russia.
Right, the former communists, yeah.
And those Orthodox traditions, Orthodox Christianity, mm-hmm. With all due respect, they tend to be much more nationalistic, inward-looking. You're a Russian Orthodox.
Yeah, I see a lot of Russian Orthodox come here on tours.
But their world is Russian, whereas the Poles, they have adopted the Latin alphabet. In other words, the same alphabet that we use in English, you know, the ABCs. Mm-hmm. They don't write in Cyrillic. And their architecture and their music and their language and grammar have all been informed by Latin, by the Catholic world. This tied them into the cultural sphere, not of Moscow, but of Rome and Paris and other centers of Catholic culture, you know?
So do you see Catholicism now maybe coming from Poland, which would be, as a Jew, this is understandably tough for me to wrap my head around, but I would be very happy to be proven wrong, in answer to some of the world's problems, as opposed to, you know, feeding into it as was in the past? Is that perhaps why you're there?
I mean, you know, religion or my faith, my personal faith, it's not an ideology or a political program. So it really is a relationship. And the truth is that if there are people who are entering into a really lively, you know, grace-filled, love-filled relationship with their creator, then that cannot be bad. You know, in Poland, I have experienced over and over. I mean, that's why, think about what that is to emigrate from Manhattan to Poland. I mean, it's a pretty radical decision. And what motivated me was love, my own love, but also I saw that there is life in these Catholic communities in this country, which I did not experience when I was living in Paris or mm-hmm. Rome or New York, for that matter. And I said, you know, this is something that is worth giving really my life for. Close my bank account, give my clothes away to my brother-in-law, move to Eastern Europe. Love has the power to do that. Now, if in Poland we have, you know, a very piously Catholic population, and young people included, you know, this is Sunday today, and there are 9 masses in the day, every Sunday, mm-hmm. starting at 7 in the morning and ending at 9:30 in the evening.
So people are searching for God.
They are, and I think that then at least, you know, if that relationship is there, I'm talking about not in a group, not in a tribe, if this relationship of love is in each individual heart, I'm talking about of this man and of this woman, mm-hmm. then at least there is that foundation, the ground is prepared for me to talk about also loving the other, loving the stranger. In other words, that Catholics should have love for the Jewish people. Now, I would add, and I think you too, that the Jewish people are not just any people. They are the chosen people, and that is in Catholic documents. I'm not being, you know, a liberal kook in the Catholic world by mm-hmm. saying that the Jews are today the chosen people. That is the official church teaching and has been for over 50 years, you know. But people are not always ready to hear that.
Right.
Now, if the person is in a relationship with God, they are learning humility. We all do. We are the creatures, and he is the creator. So we have to be humble. That kind of person who's in that relationship may be ready to hear something like that, something challenging.
So I am going to throw this out to you, and then we have to wrap this up. You, from where I'm, my perspective, don't have the luxury of just being a Catholic priest and preaching love. Because of your background, and I firmly believe that God sets us all on a certain journey, and the backgrounds that we have are because we're supposed to be doing something. So because of where you've come from, because of your more cosmopolitan perspective, shall we say, because of your connections with Jewish people also, I'm seeing that you have a calling to do something a little bit bigger. I don't know if that's the right way of saying it. You know, making sure that to try and repair some of what's happened in the past and set the stage for the future. It's not just, you know, enough to say, well, in the past this and this happened and that wasn't good, but to make sure to make the ground fertile so that it never happens again, and that Christians of all stripes and Jews can understand where we need to, with all the differences that we have, stand together. Because love is great, but sometimes it's not enough.
Well,
sometimes it's not enough in a real world. And as an Israeli sitting in a very chaotic Middle East, we see that. You know, we don't want to conquer anybody. We don't want to convert everybody on Master Judaism. We don't think we've got the only way to God. We just kind of want to be left alone to do our own thing. But reality pushes in. And and sometimes you just have to, you know, you can't just sequester yourself away. But I just wanted to tell my listeners, because when you and I were corresponding, it was the oddest thing, because you sent me a picture and you said you were in Puzna. Right? That's how you pronounce
it? I mean, in Yiddish and in Hebrew, I understand. Pozna is the
Pozna.
Name of the
city. And then it turns out they said, oh, and when it was like Germany, you know, known in Germany as Posen, and I almost fell off my chair because I have a family connection to Posen. I'm a direct descendant, which gives me great pride to say, of Rabbi Akiva Eger, who was the chief rabbi of Posen for many years, was born, you know, in 1761, died in 1835, was really a great man. His commentary on the Talmud is still learned by many every single day. And I was just like, you're in Posen? Because I never talk to anybody or meet anybody from Posen. And it was just the weirdest thing. But you said there are very few Jews there left now, right? Like a handful, if that.
Like literally a handful. I mean, there is an official Jewish community called the Gemina, which is like the German word Gemeinde, you know, which is like a, you know, a club or a loose grouping of Jews. And I think the official membership is at 9 persons, 9 people. And of course, being Jews, they all have different flavors of Judaism. Some of them are feminist liberal. Some of them are very Orthodox. And, you know, and so, you know, I was just in Krakow for the last year, and I've been there before. I spent maybe about 4 years of my life there. Now, there is a lively Jewish community. The rabbi is actually from Efrat.
I was there too. Right.
Yeah, the rabbi comes from Israel. He comes from Efrat. Right. His name is Avi Baumol. He's a friend of Shlomo Katz, who's on
your
show.
Yeah, I know him.
And he's a wonderful man, and we became friends. And we wrote like a column together in the Times of Israel. And there is a lively community around him of several hundred people, including a lot of really young people.
But Posen is not there.
But Posen is, you know, I wrote an article about this in the Times of Israel myself called The Swimmagog.
Yes, I saw that.
Not synagogue.
It was great.
Swimmagog, because the biggest synagogue in this city was desecrated by the Nazis and turned into a swimming pool,
right.
And it's still there now, and the pool is still there.
Right.
So to me, I mean, I pass it on I ride a tram through town, you know, and I was last night, I rode in the tram right past that big, it's a really monumental, you know, Reform synagogue from the late, from the early 20th century, and it stands there, and every time I see that, I'm like, ugh, you know.
Ah. I'll get there one day. I would love to. I know he's buried there, and I would love to just go and kind of search out my family roots, my very Germanic family roots. But right now, I do have to go and start my week, as do you.
All right.
Eric Ross, thank you so much for a fascinating conversation. And the next time you come to Israel, you know, let's meet.
I'll drop you a line. And thank you for this honor, and thank you for the time and the respect. I really appreciate it.
Well, and thank you for your honesty. I didn't ask such easy questions, but... you stood.
Well, you know,
do you ever take a vow of silence? Just ask.
take a vow of silence. No. Thank God. I'm too talkative for that.
Okay. All right. So everybody's got their limits. Eric Ross joining me from Poland. This is Eve Harrow. I'm Rejuvenation for the Land of Israel Network. Take care, everybody. Next week, I will be broadcasting from the United States, heading there for a speaking tour. So in the meantime, be well, everybody, and goodbye for now. This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. They belonged to the Mizrahi movement way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
Hello, my name is Tommy Waller. I'm the founder and president of HaYovel. More than 12 years ago, I made my first trip to the Land of Israel. What I saw and heard changed my life forever. I stood with Nir Levi, an Orthodox Jewish man, in his vineyard in Samaria on the Mountain of Blessing. There, he opened his Bible and read the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "You shall yet plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria." This fall, during the grape harvest, we have the opportunity to join Israel as it celebrates the 50th year of the liberation of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Come join us as we witness the unveiling of prophecy in the Jubilee year. Come be a part of the biblical narrative. Go to HaYovel.com, that's HaYovel.com, to find out more, and I hope to see you there.